This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The play Jeffrey is the only play I can think of that opens with a condom breaking. Jeffrey is a comedy about love and sex in the age of AIDS. New York Times theater critic Frank Rich described it as the funniest play of this season and maybe last season, too. My guest is the playwright, Paul Rudnick. He also wrote the hit Broadway comedy I Hate Hamlet. He wrote the screenplay for The Addams Family and its forthcoming sequel. And he wrote the screenplay that many adaptations later became Sister Act. He asked that his name be removed from the film for reasons he'll explain to us later. Rudnick is also the author of the comic novel I'll Take It, about a family of compulsive shoppers. Of course, it's easier to find humor in a shopping spree than in the AIDS epidemic. Rudnick thinks of humor as a weapon against AIDS.
When people come see the play, they're sort of not quite sure what to expect, especially when they hear that it's a comedy about AIDS. They all wonder, how is that possible? And throughout the play, there's sort of a roller coaster effect, because the play doesn't shy away from the subject matter, from AIDS and from that particular nightmare. And there are these moments when the audience will gasp or suddenly become very, very quiet. And they'll feel, oh my God, it's not a comedy anymore. You know, we won't be allowed to laugh after this. And then 5 seconds later, they're howling. And that's just, it's such a thrill for me as a writer and as a person to see that that works and that it's possible.
You know the saying that when you go to bed with someone, you're going to bed with everybody that person has ever slept with. You do that in a pretty comic way in the opening of your play. Would you describe it?
Oh, yes. Well, what I wanted the opening to be, it opens with two men in bed and they're having sex. And then one by one, the rest of the cast pop out of the bed, and suddenly you have eight people. And I based it on the idea of a clown car at the circus, where suddenly, you know, it seems like a tiny little vehicle, and suddenly the stage is packed. And the audience, you could see at the beginning, they get a little nervous because they worry when you open a play with two people having sex, sort of, where do you go from there? What are we in for? And then as everyone starts appearing, they start to laugh, and they start to just realize, okay, we're not sure what we're in for, but it seems like a good time. So, I love that kind of opening because it just really, it's the exact right image for the play, the kind of lunacy of sex, period, and certainly of sex nowadays.
You know, in talking about allowing yourself to see a comic side to the epidemic, it reminds me of an op-ed piece you wrote in the New York Times about visiting a friend in the hospital. And your friend had AIDS, and you say that he wasn't a suitably noble dying person. He wasn't only dying, he was whining. And he wouldn't even wear his new silk robe because it was too George Hamilton. How did this experience change you?
Oh, well, that was when this guy who he was dying, and he was horribly obnoxious, which I feel terrible saying that, but someone who's sick and is no longer with us. But all of his friends, myself, we kept visiting and we really tried to be supportive. And he was treating us the way a rude celebrity would treat a waiter. And even though you don't want to ever desert someone at a point like that, we finally all met in the lobby of St. Vincent's Hospital in front of a bad oil painting of the Pope and collapsed in laughter because that was all that was left. It was just, if we were going to go back up there and be handmaidens to the dying emperor, there was very little choice other than to find it amusing. And it's funny, I have a friend right now, actually, who is quite ill, although on the mend in Florida, and I've been talking to him on the phone, and it reminded me of that situation, except he actually is quite a spectacularly humorous person, and he had just been through a terrible episode of illness, of a viral thing attacking his spine, all sorts of dreadful things, but meanwhile, and his speech was a little slurred, but while I was talking to him, he said, with a little slur, he said, I know I sound like post-stroke Betty Davis. And then he said, I hate this hospital. Everywhere I turn, there are crazed candy stripers and Shanghai shame girls. And I wasn't even quite sure what he was talking about, but he seemed in a good mood, and it was his personality coming through the disease. And somehow that seemed a triumph of sorts. And that's what Jeffrey's all about, too, is that kind of victory through personality and humor.
You know, Jeffrey, your main character, says at one point, I hate sex, I hate love, I hate the world for giving me everything and then taking it back. Have you watched people go through different phases in their attitude about sex and love during the epidemic?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it was why when I first had the idea for the play, the situation of someone giving up sex because of AIDS and because of the last 10 years seemed the romantic situation of our time. And that if you were going to write a what a play that is in many ways a romantic comedy. That was the dilemma that everyone is in right now. And in the, at that point in the play, Jeffrey, the leading character, has made this vow to give up sex and then met the man of his dreams, this fantastic guy who is also HIV positive. So suddenly he's, I can't imagine being more torn between feelings of overwhelming romantic love and what are you letting yourself in for in terms of someone being sick, in terms of someone who you may then need to be taking quite a bit of care of, and just the idea of falling in love with someone who may very well not live forever. And that's the moment that Jeffrey reaches sort of towards the end of the first act when he just throws up his hands and says, these are all the things I love and they are suddenly seem forbidden. And where's the nearest bridge? And I think the play is about avoiding the nearest bridge.
Now, we were talking about funerals before. Have you spoken at many funerals?
Let me think. I've spoken sort of as one of a group of friends.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been the main act. I've never been the floor show. Also, because in New York, especially in the theatrical community where they have memorials on the stage of Broadway theaters, it's like, I'm not going to compete with Jennifer Holliday and Patti LuPone. You know, when you've got name entertainment, I think, no, I mean, I'd have to bring out White Tigers or something in order to compete. So it's that's what gets also funny is you start to feel, oh, I don't know, like tickets will be available half price at the booth sometimes for these events. But I have spoken at them, and it's, I guess, the nicest ones and the ones, the most memorable memorials are the most personal. There was one, actually, it was funny. It wasn't for a man who died of AIDS. It was for a man who died of cancer, which, it's funny, there used to be a scene in the play that it's really pushes the boundaries of taste, but everyone I know identified with it, which was when you hear about someone who didn't die of AIDS, when they have a heart attack or brain tumor, you somehow oddly think, good for them. You think, what a horrible response because they're still dead. But on the other hand, it seems oddly refreshing. I remember when Andy Warhol died and people realized it wasn't AIDS, there was this feeling of that was how original. And I think it's just because death has become so much more commonplace than anyone expected, especially at people at younger ages, that suddenly you're forced into these sort of bizarre responses.
Paul Rudnick is my guest. His comedy, Jeffrey, is playing off-Broadway. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Writer Paul Rudnick is my guest. In your previous play, I Hate Hamlet, which is about a TV actor who's about to play Hamlet, and the actor is met by the ghost of John Barrymore, who, of course, informs him how to perform. So in the part of the ghost of John Barrymore was Nicole Williamson.
God love him.
Well, tell us what happened the night that his co-star, Evan Handler, the actor who played the TV actor in your show, the night that Evan Handler walked out in the middle of the performance.
Yes. Well, no, Evan, it must be said, was a saint. Evan had, this was all tip of the iceberg time. Evan, during rehearsals, had put up with an enormous amount of dreadful misbehavior on the part of Nicole Williamson, and this was the night it finally peaked. And the first act of that play ended with a climactic stage duel with swords. And Nicole Williamson, who is egomaniac is far too kind a word. I think you would have to, any word that ends in maniac will do for Nicole. But he began to direct Evan while on stage, and this all sort of culminated in Nicole actually stabbing him and drawing blood. And Evan quite wisely left the stage at that point, and the production, and the theater. So it was the understudy finished the second act and the rest of the run of the play. And the next morning, when I came downstairs to get a magazine at my newsstand, there was a picture from the play that filled the entire front page of the New York Post with the headline, Star Swats Actor on the Butt. And that kind of phraseology, I think, may explain the troubles that the Post is having right now. But it was a story that then the media just adored. And for weeks thereafter, there were TV crews at the theater. I was getting calls from all over the world. I sort of learned to say no comment in every language. and it seemed to be somehow you could either hear Barrymore up in heaven, you know, cackling gleefully or snickering with vengeance. But it was a very wild time.
Were you in the theater that night?
No, I wasn't. And I'm grateful I wasn't. Many people were there. Even now people come up to me saying I was there as if it were Woodstock. Gregory Peck was there that night, and Elaine Stritch. I was seeing something else. I ran into the show's press agent later that night, who told me that the story was going to appear on the front page of the Times, but that Jerzy Kaczynski, the Polish author, had committed suicide that night and had bumped I Hate Hamlet back to the art section. And even though I did not wish Jerzy Kaczynski any ill, I began just laughing uncontrollably, and I was so glad he picked that night, because I thought, no, I didn't need this on the front page. But so it just had all these sort of absurd dimensions to it.
Isn't it good publicity, though, to have something really wild happen on stage?
It certainly was a lot of publicity. And I think because the play was a comedy and involved a wild figure like Barrymore, it didn't really hurt the play. It sort of fed into it. On the other hand, I felt after that evening, audiences came with real bloodlust, kind of the Roman Colosseum feeling, and were terribly disappointed when no one was stabbed. And I thought, you know, I'm sorry we'd run out of actors. So it had sort of a double-edged sword.
Very funny.
At times.
So Evan Handler was actually stabbed, not just swatted?
Well, swatted enough to draw blood.
Okay.
And cause bruises.
Okay.
And equity hearings.
Now, I know that you wrote the original version of the movie that became Sister Act, and then you eventually had your name taken off of it, and I think a lot of script doctors rewrote it. What was the difference between your conception and the movie?
Well, the original script, which I was quite fond of, was written very much as a vehicle for Bette Midler,
mm-hmm.
and to take advantage of her genius. And I wanted it to be quite subversive. It had the same overall plot, which was that of a kind of broken-down chorus girl who, for various reasons, is forced to join a convent for a brief period of time. But I think kind of the best way to put it is what was intended to be a satire of the singing nun became the singing nun. I wanted to show the triumph of a certain kind of pure show business glee over the Catholic Church, or at least the more repressive aspects of the Catholic Church, because although there are certainly positive, if not miraculous, aspects to most religions, there are also a darker side. And I wanted to show kind of Bette Midler gleefully victorious. And as the rewrites continued, and then when Bette was replaced in the role with Whoopi Goldberg, there were just demands made that I was in violent disagreement with. The movie became much more a case of sort of wholesome uplift and also just not funny, so that I eventually had no choice but to leave the project. And then I left about 2 months before filming began, and it was rewritten by at least 5 other people, so that the result was very far from my intention. The movie was very successful anyway, so what do I know? But it just was odd.
When you started writing, were there many out writers, you know, gays who were out, like yourself?
Yes. I think, you know, increasingly, certainly more and more, that there the other night I did a wonderful benefit reading for ACT UP, at which there were practically more gay novelists reading than there were people in attendance, and there was a big crowd. It's been wonderful. I think one of the great pluses of having so many gay writers is that no one writer has to carry that burden of representing all gay people forever.
Well, what about the differences between being out in Hollywood and on Broadway?
Well, I think in the theater, I mean, both sectors certainly have an enormous amount of gay people working in them. The theater has certainly been far more in the vanguard of gay subject matter, you know, both in AIDS plays in terms of The Normal Heart and As Is and terrific works like that. But just even in terms of real commercial theater, a wonderful show like Falsettos, which, you know, very much has many, many gay characters and is a smash hit on Broadway and is a musical, that just Broadway and wonderfully, I think, the theater audience has been so much more accepting, in fact, eager to hear all sorts of stories. And I think in Hollywood, there's a real fear of gay subject matter and a fear that it's not commercial, a fear that it's off-putting, which I think as time goes by will, God willing, be completely erased, because I think it just leads to so many awful decisions that every gay movie somehow then has to be very serious, and it just has to be an ultimate statement. And you think, of course, this could often end up being quite boring films because you sense all of this, you know, earnest hand-wringing going on behind them. So I think Hollywood just, you know, has to get over itself. And as it has with black films, films about women, films about all the groups that weren't considered commercial until suddenly you had a smash hit. But Hollywood lives in fear in general. You know, Hollywood is run not just on racism and homophobia, but on fear of studio executives losing their job if they produce the wrong Police Academy 8. So to try and get them to, you know, open up to in terms of subject matter is not easy.
I want to go back to the subject of AIDS for a second, which is the backdrop of your play, Jeffrey. I know a lot of people can't talk about AIDS or their fear of AIDS or their friends who have AIDS. They can't talk about it to their parents because their parents wouldn't understand. Now, I know that your late father had written a textbook about AIDS.
Yes, he had edited one of the first books on the subject at all. It was a compilation of a group of medical articles dealing with AIDS very early on.
So did that make it easy to kind of share your anxieties about your friends and, you know, who were sick with him?
Well, my parents had many gay friends and children of their friends who were sick and dying. And so they experienced it right along with me. I think very much at exactly the same time. My mother also works in the arts and for years worked for the Pennsylvania Ballet. So she was aware of it as soon as anyone else. And something else that was just meant an overwhelming amount to me was my dad actually died last summer of lung cancer, and he didn't live to see Jeffrey produced. And once I became aware that that was would probably be the case, I gave him an early draft of the play to read, and which he loved. And being able to share that with him, especially at that point, I was so grateful for that opportunity and grateful for his response. And I feel lucky and privileged beyond belief to have the family that I have, because I know many people grow up in desperately homophobic situations, and people who have AIDS or are simply gay who are rejected, if not violently abused, by their families. And mine could not have been more the reverse. I mean, my family is not, I hate just using words like accepting, because that implies that you make a decision or that, oh, aren't they doing a good deed? Because it's so far beyond that. There's, you know, they take an enormous pleasure in my life and in my friends and in their own gay friends. And it's just considered completely normal. And, oh, I can't imagine a better situation.
Did your parents end up almost becoming surrogate parents for friends of yours?
Yes. Well, my parents are quite terrific in general, so they're surrogate parents. Well, I don't know if they might be offended if we said surrogate parents. That somehow makes it sound like they're counselors at summer camp, I think. But they are, I certainly think, are cherished friends by people from every walk and gender preference group and race. They, I think one of the most important things they've taught me is curiosity. And certainly curiosity, not just as altruism and good deeds, but as a defense against boredom, that the more people you know and the more different people you know, the better time you're likely to have, and that you sort of plan your life as if it were a dinner party with one or more of each group, that it's that's the way everybody has a blast.
Paul, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Paul Rudnick's comedy, Jeffrey, is at the Minetta Lane Theater in New York.